Hi, this is Paul. I mentioned in the video I did the other day on Carefree Wandering, Hans Georg Müller, that he had a portion in his video on Marshall McLuhan, which I thought was excellent, on the rearview mirror. And I wanted to play that and talk about it because I thought it was really quite well done and quite important.
McLuhan wrote, "We look at the present through a rearview mirror. We march backwards into the future." This is actually written in the book, The Medium is the Massage.
Okay, now I want to talk about this. When he first said it, the thing that immediately came to light was this beginning of Jordan Peterson talking to Roger Scruton.
So the transcendent is the fact insofar as it's that which transcends our ignorance, but you can also think about it technically. So, and I think we know enough about how the brain works now, so that, not that we know much, so that useful things can be said about that. You tend to represent the world in the simplest manner that you possibly can that works for what you're doing. And so you don't actually see the world. You see sufficiently useful, low resolution representations of the world. And if they work, then that's fine. There's no need to adjust them, and they're relatively easy to remember and to manipulate. But now and then you have a misapprehension about someone, let's say, and you have a conversation with them, and the conversation goes sideways. And what that means is that the thing that you thought you were conversing with is not the thing that you're conversing with, and that manifests itself in error, right? So error is the place where the transcendent reveals itself. And what is actually revealing itself is the reality that's outside and underneath your perceptions. And so what you see in the world, in some sense, is a set of animated cartoons. And a lot of that is actually a consequence of you seeing nothing but your memory, because your brain is organized so that instead of going through all of the difficulty of having to look at the thing in itself, you look at what you assume to be there. And if you can get away with that, so much the better. But the thing in itself is always much richer than your apprehension of it, which is partly why you make mistakes, but also partly why you can continue to garner wisdom in the world. There's always more there than meets the eye. And God only knows how much more there's there than meets the eye. And you can show this even in the religious sense to some degree, because you could say that there's an element to the transcendent that instills people with a sense of religious significance. You can do that by immediately, scientifically, by feeding people chemicals, for example, that disrupt the...
Okay. So that business about memory is really low-resolution cartoons, because it's easier to sort of replay things than to actually take in... I mean, it's clear that our perception of the world, our interaction of the world, is far more complex and sophisticated than it feels like. And that's, you know, that's to our benefit. It's the way in which we interact the world is an accomplishment. Okay, now back to McLuhan and this idea.
Film with the same title. McLuhan says the following.
Or rather, what people see in the new is always the old thing, the rearview mirror. And what people see at any time, what their attention is focused upon, is always the rearview mirror, never the present image or the present fact.
Okay, and you know they're coming at it from two different places. Peterson is coming at it in terms of a psychological, scientific, this is what we've learned about the brain, however they've learned about it. McLuhan is paying attention to just sort of watching people and listening to them, and these are much broader, less technical observation of human cognition.
The future of the future is the present. And this is something that people are terrified of.
And that's helpful to just pause. Because the first time I played this, I heard, the future of the future is the present. Wait a minute. Let me pause and think that through. In other words, if I'm seeing everything I'm seeing right now, I'm seeing through my past. The future of my future is right now. In other words, I am continually developing, transforming, being changed, all of this.
The pronouncement about the rearview mirror is followed up with the following sentence.
Suburbia lives imaginatively in Bonanza Land.
Suburbia lives imaginatively in Bonanza Land. And he explains this in the following way.
Yeah, they live in Bonanza Land. One stage back, the Cartwright territory is a much more comfortable territory to live in than modern suburbia.
So in other words, he's taking this reality that Peterson is talking about, and he's taking it even further back, that this living through the past, which is sort of the only background we have to, that sort of forms us and creates us, it's the only thing that we have to live from. And of course, he's talking in the late 60s about the not too distant past, which was the 40s and the 50s, let's say the heyday of the Western. And, you know, if you've been through the channel enough, you know that we've been talking about Westerns a fair amount lately. Westerns were they were the dominant genre of Hollywood movies. And the rest of the world is sort of feeding off American media. And so the Western was deeply impactful. The Western then, of course, you see that this keeps going back. The Western, this canvas that was used to work through all sorts of stories and ideas and thoughts. And we've talked about that a fair amount lately.
That is, emotionally, it is much more gratifying and secure to live in Bonanza Land, and it is the old environment. Every time a new environment forms or the new medium, people go back and live in the old one. When the Cartwrights were actually running USA, say back in 1850, 1870.
Here too, McLuhan is Žižek-esque. He refers to the popular TV series Bonanza of the 1960s. Which portrayed the Wild West.
And even someone my age, these things were in syndication, and so I don't recall hardly ever sitting down and watching through a whole Bonanza episode, but it was on TV a lot, and you can still find it. There's one of these streaming channels. There's all these streaming channels on free TV now called Grit, and it's just like Westerns all the time.
Popular in the 1960s and presented the Wild West. At a time, the 1960s.
And again, we've covered the Westerns a fair amount.
When new technologies, television and so forth, were developing rapidly. And along with this, also new identity technologies. McLuhan's point is that at this time, people found comfort in the old technologies. On the one hand, the technologies of the Wild West before, for instance, cars. And also the old identity technologies that constructed the old heroes of the rural West rather than the new suburban man in front.
Or at least the images of the heroes in the suburban West. And I've spoken before about George Marston's book, The Twilight of the American Enlightenment, where he spends a fair amount of time going through the angst of the 50s, the corporate man, the plastic man, and of course all of that angst in the 1950s in American culture would give birth to this age of, I don't know if I'm using authenticity in the same way that Mueller is, but age of authenticity. 60s would be self-expression, trying to break out of the plastic corporate man, the square, the straight.
Front of the television set. For McLuhan, Bonanza Land, on the one hand, represents the old technologies that predated electronic technologies.
And of course, the Western that the 1950s and 60s were relating to and seeing themselves through, this memory that they were feeding off of, it was actually one, it was the Hollywood Western. And anybody who wants to do any reading study of Western films knows that there's a lot going on there. It's not just as simple as, oh, Americans were acting like the frontier, even though the vast majority of Americans never even got close to the frontier.
But on the other hand, it also represents the old identity technologies. And he calls these identity cards that no longer work. Let's listen to him.
In the new electric world, where everybody is involved in everybody, where everybody is involved in complex processes that are going on in the total environment, the old identity cards that used to constitute private identity, the old means of finding out who am I, will not work.
And then he goes on like this to further explain those old identity cards.
The old methods of merely external identity by marks of occupation, national origin, age grouping, and so on, these will not serve any longer as means of distinguishing private identity.
Okay, now what's helpful here is, so I'm going to take it all the way back to, let's say, Rome, Roman culture, very, very little privacy. Privacy comes in, I think he's going to talk about this actually a little bit, in terms of boxes. And so what we have through our screens, through SET, is a, now there's a new, we're living in a new world that is fabricated for us from the storytellers, from SET, from all of this, instead of a world that is much more dependent on direct interaction between human beings.
Clearly, these identity cards are the cards of sincerity, the formation of identity in orientation to traditional social roles. However,
and again, his definition of sincerity, still don't know that I'm terribly comfortable with it. And also, when you say traditional social roles, which tradition? The 1950s or the 1930s and 20s or the 19th century? Part of, even though you can certainly find continuity, part of all of this is tremendously low resolution, as if post-industrial age tradition was the same as pre-industrial age tradition. I've been reading a lot of reading and listening to a lot of history from the 19th century. The 19th century is just this massive dislocation in Europe. I've talked about Vatican I. The Rest is History just had an excellent episode on 1848 and the revolutions. So yeah, it's really, really low resolution to just say, well, there's traditional and then there's modern. There's a lot of traditional.
In this very clip, McLuhan also contradicts himself. Contrary to what he says otherwise, and again, this confirms that he was not really the most consistent or coherent theorist, McLuhan identifies here the new identity of the electronic age in terms of authenticity. Let's listen to it.
People now have to encounter themselves in the inner world, Kierkegaard or existential style, in order to know who they are.
What McLuhan says here is that the bonanza land, created in the media of the 1960s, is a land of sincerity as seen in the rearview mirror. And it is seen while it's making way for the new electronic world, which is depicted here in terms of authenticity as the inner world Kierkegaard style. So he basically claims here that authenticity is replacing the bonanza land. But again, this is not his usual claim.
Now, if we go all the way back to my very first videos and we talk about Neil Postman and Amusing Ourselves to Death, and we look at, let's say, the world of print of the 19th century, this is an interior world. And it's a world of, when you read, especially in the 19th century, now it's interesting to note that Abraham Lincoln was thought to be unusual because it was quite common, even in the 19th century, to read aloud when you read. At some point, people began reading, quote unquote, silently. Well, they just read listening in their mind, or they just read even without necessarily articulating the words in their mind. You see all of this development taking place, but we very much see the movement of people by these technologies in terms of how exactly they are fashioning and shaping their world. Are they living this way as we're having these conversations? I just noted that Yosef had a couple of response videos to my recent videos. I haven't watched them yet. So there's a lot. We're processing in a different way than, let's say, I did 10 years ago here in my study, just me alone with my books. Sounds like a Simon and Garfunkel song.
You will now see that he does not describe commonly the electric world in terms of authenticity, but rather in terms of profelicity. Of course, he doesn't use the notion of profelicity, but his very central concept of the global village is an early predecessor of the notion of profelicity. McLuhan's global village, contrary to that short clip about Kierkegaard and the inner self, was for McLuhan normally precisely not a place of authenticity. And this is outlined in great detail in his book, The Gutenberg Galaxy. Here, he introduces the global village in the context of the transition from what he calls the Gutenberg Galaxy, represented by Gutenberg man, to the global village. The Gutenberg man stands for traditional print technology, books. These promote individualism, connected, for instance, with authenticity and with personal fragmentation and with an emphasis on privacy. Crucially, the new electronic media that constitute the global village destroy privacy. They bring back what McLuhan calls the tribal world.
Now, if you watched all the way through towards the end of the conversation about the marriage crisis, Rod talked about the camera and how the camera is changing us, how we're always being watched. Many of us have seen Louder, the Crowder guy, saying, you know, treating his wife abysmally. How did these videos come out from, and did someone break into their Amazon account? Probably not. Probably his wife, with whom he is having a divorce struggle with, heard him on his podcast sort of blaming her for the divorce and thinking, oh, you want to play the social media game? I bet you more people will watch videos of you being mean to me than will watch your video of yourself defending. And then Rod made the point that it's amazing how much rationalization was going on in the comment section for that video.
Now, rather than separate individuals, we all live in a village together, knowing what everyone else does basically all the time. Instead of
a little bit of an exaggeration, but right.
An inner world, we now inhabit a shared common world of simultaneity and great constant mutual involvement. That is
now if we pause here and consider that the future of the future is the present, and we're seeing the unfolding present future-ish through the lenses of the past, we can get a sense of how, for, let's say, older people might like me, the world of set is impacting the world of YouTube.
Is the global village. The electronic world of the global village is not an inner world of individual selves, but precisely its opposite, a social world of total mutual involvement. McLuhan says as much here.
Well, I think you'll find everything we observe tonight about the media points in the direction of tribal man and away from individual man.
By individual man, I assume that you're referring to John's literary man.
Yes, and tribal man is the man created by the new electronic media.
So this would be the basic change we spoke of at the beginning.
Yes, we're retribalizing.
Now again, if you look at someone his age on this black and white TV, with 4:3 aspect ratio. He, of course, is living much more in private, interior, individual reading land, and they are just, this is very early television.
Voluntarily, we're getting rid of individualism. We're in a process of making a trial. For just as books and their private point of view are being replaced by the new media, so the concepts which underlie our actions, our social life, are changing. We are no longer so concerned with self-definition, with finding our own individual way. We're more concerned with what the group knows, of feeling as it does, of acting with it, not apart from it.
And here we have this wonderful short clip describing tribal man, the inhabitant of the new global village. Tribal men and women are humans shaping their identities in loops, in communication feedback loops. Like in a traditional village, where also everyone was constantly getting feedback from everyone else and was observing how everyone else observed them.
And of course, this is early television. The feedback loops, the audience capture, that's far more now.
Kluwen says,
the idea of feedback, of being involved in one's, participating in one's own audience participation, is a natural product of this circuitry. Yeah. Everything under electric conditions is,
again, audience capture,
is looped. You become folded over into yourself, into your image of yourself changes completely.
This is an early description of profilicity. To highlight, two important aspects of the global village are, first, there is no privacy. As in pre-individualist society, in pre-modern society, in the actual old tribal society, there is a return to tribal communality. McLuhan says,
privacy was almost unknown, even in Shakespeare's day. It came in after that period, in the 17th, 18th centuries, and it was dependent upon an architecture that sealed off spaces. People didn't live in private spaces in earlier periods, and it was with the coming of the book and the need for areas and private areas in which to read and study and so on that privacy gradually caught on as a value. I don't think privacy has quite the same meaning in our time that it used to have. I know, for example, a big business in Toronto where all the private offices have been dissolved, all the walls have been pulled out so that the participants in this business can sit together around tables.
It's called cubicles. You know, and again, you go into a major office floor, you're pretty high up there status-wise if you have a door on your office.
Tables in the middle of the big office space so that they can watch each other's responses to stocks and world events and so on. They want a perpetual dialogue going on among themselves as a response to world events.
In such a world, where we need constant feedback.
I didn't have any saving throws for that thing.
Oops. Privacy and individuality and authenticity, as it is associated with, for instance, private silent reading or unshared personal ideas.
Now what's really interesting is that the McLuhan almost makes it seem like, well, no more privacy. No, but the changes are usually not that total. You have a sense of privacy with your own little screen. And if someone wrenches it out of your hands and decides to scroll through your text messages. So even in this, we have the private and the public, although the private is not anywhere near as private as we might imagine it to be.
Makes no sense. Like on YouTube, in the global village, we want constant reaction by our peers. The value of privacy that is still so often heard of and mentioned in the global village is, in fact, a rear view mirror value left over from the age of authenticity.
And I think that's an overstatement. It doesn't go away. The rear view mirror continues to be a part of it. And
Secondly, although the global village is a communal place, it's not a place of perfect harmony at all. McLuhan says,
the global village is at once as wide as the planet and as small as a little town where everybody is maliciously engaged in poking his nose into everybody else's business. The global village is a world in which you don't necessarily have harmony. You have extreme concern with everybody else's business. And
again, there's a ton of wokeism in there. Isn't this the complaint of the new tyranny from the left that there's, you can't even have a thought that's your own. I remember this was before the Jordan Peterson thing. I remember I found this website, Everyday Feminism, and I went through it and I thought, the law of Moses is far less intrusive than these people.
Much involvement in everybody else's life.
The global village does not represent some form of idyllic return back to nature. It is a place of mutual surveillance by technological means and of constant feedback interference. Now, finally, to the vortex of energy. In You and Your Profile, we start with an epigraph from McLuhan, which is taken from a 1975 lecture on man and media. Here it is.
The huge vortices of energy created by our media present us with similar possibilities of evasion, of consequences, of destruction. By studying the pattern of the effects of this huge vortex of energy that in which we're involved, it may be possible to program a strategy of evasion and survival.
McLuhan here refers to a story by Edgar Allan Poe titled A Descent into the Maelstrom, which is about a sailor who is about to drown in a vortex. And in order to survive, he observes the objects that reappear in the maelstrom or in the vortex. And then eventually he clings on to them. So he studies the pattern of the vortex in order to finally be able to survive in its midst. I think this is a powerful allegory.
I can't watch that thing full screen.
That basically shows that the media, like this vortex of energy, are shaping us, shaping our movements. They are the environment that condition us. And they are neither right nor wrong. We live...
I'd say they're sometimes right and sometimes wrong, and sometimes more neutral. It's hard to say neither right nor wrong and sort of lodge them in neutrality. But, I mean, and this is even more so than McLuhan, because, of course, you have the Arab Spring, which people thought, well, that's going to change the world. Once everyone has Twitter, then because of the lack of privacy, no sin can be undone, because now via Twitter we can publicly shame our enemies. And once we employ shame weaponized by social media, then we can make the world right.
Live inevitably in and with them. And in order to survive, to do well in them, to achieve well-being, we should not try and go against them. This is a kind of Taoist survival strategy. And it's also a Stoic survival strategy, because we survive by reflective understanding and adaptation. So I guess the point of the metaphor is that we need to study the technologies that condition us and that condition our self-making in order not to drown in these technologies mindlessly.
It's nice to imagine if we have some kind of conscious understanding of the impact that protects us. I don't have any 20-sided die here to do a Grim Grizz saving throw, but I don't think just being aware of it doesn't mean you're immune from it. I think it's far deeper and far more subtle than that.
This also means we need to become aware of our identity technologies, which function in...
This idea that awareness somehow is a prophylactic from influence and seduction. When you look at what really grabs people, we just use addiction, for example, alcohol. What really grabs people, the alcoholic, to everyone else, they look at the alcoholic and say, they're an alcoholic. Their love is their bottle. The alcoholic is in denial. I could stop anytime I wanted to. Oh. And so it's a little naive. Well, just if we're aware of it, we'll know. I don't think so.
Mutual feedback loops with electronic technologies. So here's a conclusion. Three main takeaways.
Now, it's also interesting to note that we'll have to see. Let's see if we go all the way to the beginning. No. You see, if you go to... Let's jump to one of his early videos when he first started doing this. All right, so there's his channel, and you can see, I think the first videos I saw of his were probably, did some stuff on Kant, did some stuff on Jordan Peterson. But again, if we go all the way back to his first videos, he started out with, this must have... He used to have like this warning that came up. Where's the warning? Is it at the end? No, we'll have to find it.
Your continuance.
Okay, here it is. This was his savings throws back in the day.
Support of this channel. And
warning, this video is produced for attracting your attention and to promote the channel. The platform you are using is designed to be addictive and to mine your data for profit. You want to know why Grim Grizz is a genius? Compare this little black, red on black to something like this.
You have a respect for serious play?
Yes.
I have a ritual with my channel where, like reminding fish that they're in water, I remind people that there's a lot of mind control out there, even if you just consider advertisement, by offering... Yeah. Them savings throws against mind control using these dice where they choose between survival, social, wisdom, or heart to base their savings throw on. If it's over 10, they take half damage from the mind control in the rest of the episode. And given that you're a masterful wizard, they're gonna need their savings throws today. So, to them I say, choose!
I choose now?
Yes, survival, social, wisdom, or heart.
Wisdom.
Survivalists, with a 9, taking full damage. Socialists, prime 17, they're gonna be alright. Lovers of wisdom, 18. And heart folks as well, 18. Excellent. This is safe for everybody.
So, which do you think is more effective? All right, let's finish this off.
First, instead of advocating a rearview mirror return to an idealized past, make sure to survive in the new electronic environment and in the new media by describing these patterns dispassionately and by understanding them. Unlike so many others today, don't just look.
A moral admonition here.
Look into the rear view mirror of authenticity. Don't develop a nostalgia.
What's funny is that there's absolutely no justification for why. Actually, one might think, maybe you should pay attention to the rearview mirror because at least that worked. And in the middle of this, this might not work.
Nostalgia for authenticity in the Netflix land that nowadays simulates authenticity.
And I don't think these are bad admonitions, but it's just...
Just as in the 90s.
These two are coming at us from the future, and we're going to have to be evaluated by the transcendent, which is error.
1960s, the Bonanza Land simulated sincerity. But also, unlike the technology apologists, don't succumb to profelicity enthusiasm. Be aware of the dangers of this vortex of energy, where we can easily drown in endless social validation feedback loops.
And I would say that your protection from this in many ways has everything to do with your grounding in the rearview mirror, quite frankly. It's sort of a, again, C.S. Lewis, a chronological snobbery to imagine, no, this isn't much protection at all. Now, I haven't finished watching this video. This video, Kale and Byrne and others were on Twitter. You gotta watch this video. So I'm just into the video, but I have not finished watching this video. But some of the points that they make very quickly are strong, and they might suggest, you know, it's almost a trope in movies when they're in a car and they pull the rearview mirror off the windshield and throw it in the back seat. Don't do that.
Sort of three rules of technology that we want to quickly go through with you that relate to what we're going to talk about.
This just names the structure of the problem. So first, when you invent a new technology, you uncover a new class of responsibility. And it's not always...
This is a really interesting observation. It sounds a little long. I'm going to try and bump it up.
Obvious what those responsibilities are. So to give two examples, we didn't need the right to be forgotten to be written into law until computers could remember us forever. It's not at all obvious that cheap storage would mean we'd have to invent new law. Or we didn't need the right to privacy to be written into law until mass-produced cameras came onto the market, right?
We're touching on... In other words, and this got into some of my... I haven't watched the Christian critique of John Vervaeke's AI thing yet either. It's been busy. It's been busy. I'll just say that. But these are really strong points. And this was part of my points about threshold, too, because we're the future of the future is the present. So we're not going to know how much we screwed up until we see all the product of the screwing up all around us.
Right, and Brandeis had to essentially from scratch invent the right to privacy. It's not in the original Constitution. And of course, to fast forward just a little bit,
We're even still debating that right to privacy in the Constitution, especially with respect to Roe v. Wade.
Pension economy, we are still in the process of figuring out how to write into law that which the attention economy and the engagement economy takes from us. So when you invent a new technology, you uncover a new class of responsibility. And then two, if that technology confers power, it will start a race. And if you do not coordinate, the race will end in tragedy. There's no one single player that can stop the race that ends in tragedy.
And then I'll say, okay, so we got to coordinate. And this is part of what's interesting about the AI conversation. So, we got to coordinate. Okay. How well did coordinate go? This thing starts with the example of nuclear weapons. How well did coordination go with nuclear weapons? Oh, well, we had the non-proliferation treaty. How's that going? North Korea, Iran. This is a lot. This is, you know, these are little computer boxes and networks. How's that coordination going when it conveys power and therefore initiates a race so that the race doesn't end in tragedy? Yeah, this is sobering.
That's really what the social dilemma was about.
And I would say that social dilemma and social media was actually humanity's first contact moment between humanity and AI. I'm curious if that makes sense to you, because it's when you...
I I'm still not sure of that. I think with some of these elements, we sort of had a threshold, but in some ways, the more I think about this, the more I see this in terms of very ancient perspectives of spiritual conflicts, of conflicts of spirits, of principalities and powers. Someone in the comment section says, "Well, define those." Well, it's not necessarily easy, because on one hand, I'm resisting the either or of sort of a Cartesian imagination that just this all goes back to the second conversation I had with Jonathan Peugeot, because having that conversation, that was sort of an example of Peterson's. You bumped into something, and I bumped into Peugeot, and I'm thinking something's going on here. Because what begins, and I think you can go all the way back to Plato with respect to writing. I think actually, and then through McLuhan, writing was first contact with AI. And maybe AI, artificial isn't a good word. It's instantiated human, it's human horcrux intelligence. We take something of ourselves and then we put it into written word. And of course, little clay tablets, little cuneiform tablets with those, looks like, you know, basically chicken scratch on them. And now we're able to have some sense of the thoughts of the ancient Assyrians through these little clay tablets, and on and on and on. And of course, once these little clay tablets can be sort of passed around, now suddenly you have, in that sense, a degree of artificial intelligence, and it's just been getting bigger and faster and bigger and faster. Whereas before, even if it wasn't clay tablets, it was memory. It was still closer to us. It hadn't been sort of instantiated far from us. And the clay tablets have just been getting more and more and more powerful since then. So I think we're continuing to pass thresholds. But just as, you know, when Mary Harrington notes transhumanism begins with safe and reliable and economical and ubiquitous contraception, Horcrux intelligence begins with writing.
You open up TikTok and you scroll your finger, you just activated the supercomputer, the AI pointed at your brain to calculate and predict with increasing accuracy the perfect thing that will keep you scrolling. So we already had...
It isn't perfect, because I'm not scrolling right now.
We now have every single day an AI, which is a very simple technology, just calculating what photo, what video, what cat video, what birthday to show your nervous system to keep you scrolling. But that fairly simple technology...
As is a good story.
...was enough in the first contact with AI to break humanity with information overload, addiction, doom scrolling, sexualization of kids, shortened attention spans, polarization, fake news, and breakdown of democracy. And no,
a little catastrophizing there. And I'm not saying that any of these things aren't valid, but there'll be another election. And, you know, again, I believe it was Socrates that was getting quite concerned about these, you know, written text, and then or Plato. But then, of course, Plato was such a wizard that we're still reading his texts today. And when you look at texts that ancient that get our attention, you know, he's pretty, you know, he's after the Bible, but he's way before Shakespeare. So I think maybe that's a good place to stop. I'm going to very much want to watch this whole video, but I really like that. Well, you know, did I really like Mueller's treatment did I really like Mueller's treatment of Marshall McLuhan, or did I really like Marshall McLuhan? I was almost the same. That's what we do with videos. We, you know, when I started this YouTube channel, I thought a lot about what Rod Dreher was doing with his blog and thought, I should probably do something like that with video. And then I went to YouTube, discovered, oh, lots of people are sort of doing something like that with video. You know, read the whole thing. But I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I wanted to be more me. And I guess, you know, it's also sort of like Reader's Digest. And you're not all going to watch all of the videos that I refer to in this, but you'll get a little taste. And it's this sifting through each other that in many ways that doesn't create the principalities and powers, but it's at that level that in many ways the principalities and powers are activating. I got to play one more thing that my Consciousness Congress said. This is key.
If there is an answer, it is going to be produced by asking the question.
Yeah.
You know, and the difficulty we face, as I think you're right to say, is we don't have much in answer to that at the moment.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is the solution is within that answer to a lot of this stuff. And we're all, you know, those of us who are thinking about this stuff, we're all going to have to agree on something beyond not liking the other people. That's just going to have to happen.
Yeah.
And that may mean the problem for a lot of people, particularly the sort of more liberal of us, is...
Now, that sounded a little... You can watch the video and see the whole thing, of course. But it's agreement. What is that? It's a spirit that moves, and it moves through lots of people. And lots of people are moving in the same direction, and they're doing good things, and their outcomes are good, and their outcomes are stable. Well, how do we know that? Well, we have to sort of look in that rearview mirror, because that's in many ways a lot of what we've got.
We don't like telling other people what to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And once you get into the realms of, you know, it's family, it's this and it's that, there's a hesitation there.
One of the things that Rod has said repeatedly in the marriage conversations has been, and I can't say it as well as he can. I'll probably have to go back and snip it out. But once everything becomes optional, everything changes. And a deep focus in the marriage conversation that we had was, when things weren't optional, when we were basically living in that rearview mirror and have a family, have children, and you were basically pushed through this, and not saying there weren't casualties, not saying bad things didn't happen to adults trapped in bad marriages and kids trapped in bad marriages with bad parents. All of those things are out there, but there was a lot in there that kept the world going, because it was very much a rear view mirror perspective. And, you know, part of the AI conversation and the warning is we're not smart enough to look into the future and know what's coming. We simply are not. And even just saying that sentence makes very little sense, because there's the smart that you and I might be as individuals, but there's the smart that we are together. And if it's a good spirit that is actually inhabiting and flowing through a group, that good spirit can be smarter than the individuals, but it can also be dumber than the individuals. I mean, a mob is a destructive spirit that flows through. Again, the 1848, the rest is history. There was smart and unsmart stuff going through those revolutions, and many of those revolutions are still with us in the form of bits and pieces of Constitution. This week's The Rest is History, if you're a Rest is History Club member, look at me hawking these guys. If you're a Rest is History Club member, is coronations. And I haven't dug into the coronations podcast yet. I'm super excited for it, because as Tom Holland shows, coronations are sort of a moment where you can sort of orient yourself to this memory of the past and see yourself in the light of successive spirits that have gone on through the world. I'm about to get to what James Orr says here, because it's really quite profound. It's the teaser for the video.
That perhaps is a reflection of the fact that 30 or 40 years ago, there were a lot of people going, you must have a family. And none of us wanted to be told that because we wanted to make our own choices in life. But maybe there is an opportunity to work out a more, and this is what Peterson and I talked about when I was on his podcast, is it has to be sort of invitational, enrolling. It has to be like, you don't have to have a family. You don't have to do anything. You're a free, atomized individual.
You're going to have to sell it to me. You're going to use propaganda? Will the savings throws work? How exactly is this going to get promoted? There's going to have to be a spirit that blows through because, you know, what Constantine is describing here is a spirit that has blown through, and it has blown through and causing anxiety about population collapse because birth rates have fallen.
Just like you believe. However, if you want to have a good life, here's some of the things that people have found in the past that do help you towards that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it looks like.
Couldn't agree more. Read old books, trust old books, because you need to recognize that ideas age in reverse. We get weaker as we get older. Ideas get stronger as they get older.
Let's pause and say, we get weaker as we get older. Spirits get stronger as they get older. This is Nassim Taleb's great point about the Lindy effect. Spirits get stronger as they get older.
And there's a deep truth to that. When you're trying to implement a new ideology, you want historical ground zero. You want everybody to forget the past. It's Orwell's old line, whoever controls the past controls the present, whoever controls the present controls the future and all.
If you, again, you listen to The Rest is History, 1848, that was a great episode. The professor wrote the book about 1848, made the comment that nationalism just swept through Europe in the middle of the 19th century. Nationalism only worked because it pretended to be ancient, but there was nothing ancient about it. That a lot of the costumes and the stories, these were all very, very new in the 19th century. I said 19th century. These are very, very new in the 19th century, but they were made to look old. And nationalism just, you know, it just took the day.
And all of that. So, yeah, read old books, not on Kindle. that would be, I think that would be, you know, wise advice. And don't neglect the wisdom of the past.
Spoken like a true conservative.
Pay attention to that rearview mirror. All right, that's it for this. Leave a comment. I believe I'll post this on Friday morning. And I'm assuming I'm probably going to do Bridges of Meaning Discord Q&A Friday morning, unless there's a reason I can't. So anyway, leave a comment.